welcome everybody. Congratulate you on coming out for some Torah on such a cold and untoward evening. You're here for a good reason. We have with us as a guest Rabbi Dov Linzer, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Chol Beit Torah. It's a pleasure to welcome him. His topic this evening is entering into churches and mosques, and his approach is going to be a very practical one. A few words about Rabbi Linzer. He's, as I said, the Rosh Yeshiva. He's co-mentor of the Ma'orot Leadership Fellowship Program for undergraduates. He received the Javits and Wexner Graduate Fellowships, has done graduate work in philosophy, and is pursuing a doctorate in religion at Columbia University. Hopefully he'll catch up to it. He's published in Torah journals and lectured widely in synagogues and conferences on topics related to halakha, orthodoxy, and modernity. And it's a pleasure to have him here tonight.
Thank you very much, David. And I want to repeat the thanks to all of you for turning out tonight. It is a cold and snowy night. And the topic, although it's entitled Entering into Churches and Mosques, the focus really will be on churches and on Jewish attitude towards Christianity, but specifically in the context of entering into churches. And this is really an appropriate topic, of course, for this time of year. We find ourselves exactly in the week right now between Hanukkah and Christmas. And certainly the way in which the Jewish, us as a minority religion within the United States, and our Jewish holidays and rituals are confronting the larger culture of Christmas, and although it's, we live in the secular, the public sphere is secular, still the overwhelming feeling of the Christmas period is certainly one that makes us reflect on our relationship to Christianity. It reminds me of an article I remember reading about 20 years ago in Time magazine, which was speaking about interfaith couples and how this time of year is particularly very difficult because, you know, do you have a Christmas tree? Do you also have a Hanukkah menorah? How do you handle it? And when it was explaining about when Hanukkah falls out, it says, you know, Christmas always comes at the same time of the year. It comes on December 25th. But Hanukkah can come at very different times. It comes at the beginning of December, middle of December, end of December, sometimes even January. So the next week, there was a letter to the editor, and it said, oh, you goyim, you can never get anything right. Hanukkah comes always on the same time, you know, on the 25th of Kislev, but who can figure out Christmas? Sometimes at the beginning of Kislev, sometimes at the end of Kislev, sometimes even in Teves. So it all really depends on your perspective. And, certainly the question about how we as a minority religion are received here in the United States and how do we reciprocate that is a very central one. And I want to read to you, not on the score sheets, but actually two interesting just brief news items that actually my assistant who's here, Jennifer Garitza, pointed out to me that were just recently in the news. The first is from the New York Times that was talking about, yes, there are rabbis in Montana. This was from December 4th, and it reports the following. It says, Hanukkah has a special significance in Montana these days. In Billings in 1993, vandals broke windows in homes that were displaying menorahs. In response organized by local church leaders, more than 10,000 of the city's residents and shopkeepers put makeshift menorahs in their own windows to protect the city's three dozen or so Jewish families. The vandalism stopped. So very powerful, obviously, reminds us of similar events that happened in other times in history, in the Holocaust, the very rare times when the people came together to protect the Jewish, the Jews among them. Now contrast that to what appeared a week earlier in the Jerusalem Post, the following article, Mouth Filled with Hatred. Father Samuel Aghoyan, a senior Armenian Orthodox cleric in Jerusalem Old City, says he's been spat at by young Haredi and National Orthodox Jews about 15 to 20 times in the past decade. The last time it happened was earlier this month. I was walking back from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and I saw a boy in a yarmulke and ritual fringes coming from the Western Wall, and he spat at me two or three times. And the article at great length details how this is not a rare, unusual occurrence, but it's actually an occurrence that happens every single day and every single week, and that the Armenian Catholics in Jerusalem in particular have really just had to tolerate it on an ongoing basis and don't feel that they're being protected by the police or that the police actually care. Thankfully, the one bright light is it does say in the middle of this, the only Israeli authority who has shown any serious concern for one high official in Christian and Jewish interfaith activist credit for stepping into the fray is Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi Yonah Metzger, who not in all other areas does he actually take these types of progressive positions. But here he speaks about it to Chil Hashem and Darkei Shalom, and we have to do everything we can to stop this type of behavior. So it's actually, I think, worth reflecting on this, the difference between these two attitudes. Because on the one hand, I don't think it'll come as a surprise to anybody that there are a lot of statements in the Gemara and that are negative towards non-Jews in general, before we even get to the issue of Christians. And certainly there was very negative attitudes towards Christians throughout the Middle Ages. Now, that's a question of attitudes. It's not a halachic question. We're going to be looking at the halachic question. But to some degree, that's understandable. You're a minority religion, and you're being oppressed by, and sometimes actually killed and murdered by, the larger dominant religion. So it will lead to very negative types of feelings and attitudes. It's very different, of course, for us as Americans, as a minority religion, and Jewish Americans who feel protected and who benefit from freedom of religion through living in America. And I think there it engenders a very different feeling. It engenders a feeling of a desire for reciprocity and for trying to very positive feeling towards the way in which our religion is respected, and a desire to show that in return. It's interesting, the phenomenon in Israel, because the phenomenon in Israel of that story about the spitting is actually a case of neither of the two, neither a minority religion that's being oppressed or a minority religion that's being protected, but actually a majority religion. And what happens when you go from being the minority religion to being the majority religion, and then how do you then feel towards the minority religions in your midst? It's sad, but perhaps not surprising, that sometimes some of the bigotry and the biases can come out, and these types of behaviors can be so prevalent. So I think it's really worth reflecting about how our attitudes have changed over time and might change depending on the society in which we find ourselves. So all that is in way of introduction about some of the landscape when we approach this issue about how Judaism has treated Christianity. And again, we're now going to shift from the attitudinal question to the more halachic question about how halachically has it been categorized, and how do we think about this question about entering into churches. Now, I'll start by saying that many of you are probably aware that classically throughout the Middle Ages, Christianity has been defined in halacha as avodah zarah. Now, avodah zarah is often translated as idolatry, a word that does not, for many, if not all of the people here in the audience, does not really ring true as a description of Christianity. And avodah zarah really does not mean idolatry. Avodah zarah is a halachic term, which means foreign worship. And it's a type of a prohibited form of worshiping God, or the God whom you worship, which I'll talk about in a minute. But this was the label that was attached to Christianity, and therefore all of the halachic statements in the Gemara that relate to different ways of treating non-Jews who are Ovdei Avodah Zarah, worshippers of Avodah Zarah, was assumed to apply to Christianity. And of course, the one we're going to be focusing on tonight is the issue about entering into a house of Avodah Zarah, which in this case would be entering into a church. So the question I want to start with is, why is it that Christianity was defined as Avodah Zarah? What is it about Christianity that warrants such a definition? Now, it's quite interesting that although there are many, many Gemaras about the issue of Avodah Zarah, there is nowhere any description of what type of religious system, what type of belief constitutes Avodah Zarah. Certainly what the Gemara does focus on in Sanhedrin is a major description about the type of worship, you know, whether it's sacrifices or pouring oil, anointing, the types of worship acts that constitute Avodah Zarah, but that assumes that they're being directed to a pagan god, to some type of a god that by definition is a worship of Avodah Zarah. But in terms of what exactly is that theology, what would define that as a false worship, is never actually described. The entire Masechet tractate of Avodah Zarah talks about rabbinic restrictions between Jews and non-Jews, but never describes what exactly is the theology that would constitute it. Perhaps, you know, it was so obvious to the Gemara, especially if you're living in pagan times, everything around you with all of the idols and the multiple gods and so on, you don't need to describe it. You maybe only need to describe it when you deal with more borderline cases like Christianity, and the Gemara, though, never really does get into that analysis. There is one passage in the Gemara, though, that in passing seems to just take for granted that Christianity is Avodah Zarah. This is the only passage in the Gemara that explicitly relates to this. A number of passages refer to early Christianity, at least as a Jewish heresy, don't refer to it as another religion and as Avodah Zarah. But there is one passage in the beginning of Masechet Avodah Zarah where it talks about the prohibition of doing business with people that worship Avodah Zarah on the day of their holiday, because they will then give thanks to their God and you are supporting the worship of Avodah Zarah. So the Talmud quotes the position of Rabbi Yishmael, who says you can't do it 3 days before or 3 days after. And the Gemara then says the following. If you take a look here, it's on the handout. It's on source number 3. Amar Pechlifa Barzini Amar Shmuel. Now, our text in the Gemara is Yom Rishon L'divrei Rabbi Yishmael Olam Asur. Sunday is always forbidden. Doesn't exactly explain why. The original text actually said Notzri, Christians, L'divrei Rabbi Yishmael Olam Asur, is always forbidden. Often there's a lot of censorship that takes place in texts that relate to non-Jews as a way Jews engage in a process, actually, of self-censoring. Because rather than having the church find all of the problematic statements and the church get involved in censoring the Talmud, the Jews engaged in their own process of self-censoring. The primary one was they changed all the terms in the Talmud that refer to non-Jews. If anybody here has learned Gemara before, what's the classic Gemara term that refers to non-Jews?
Akum,
right? Akum is an abbreviation of Ove Kochavim Umazalot, a worshiper of of the stars and of the constellations. Actually, that is not in any of the original texts, and you see that when you read the Rishonim. All the original texts have either Goy or Nachri, non-Jew, or Nachri a foreigner, meaning a non-Jew. But as a way that the Jews could say, these texts don't apply to you. You know, you're our friends. We don't have anything against you. They only apply to those ancient pagans, those Ovi Kochavim Umazolos. So all the texts were then, you know, self-censored. Then the word Goy was taken out and the word Akum was put in. Somebody told me they actually once saw a Siddur. I don't know if I believe this, but anyway, once saw a Siddur that said, Mi ka'amcha Yisrael Akum Echad Ba'ari. So that's what happened if you do it a little too much. But anyway, so this Gemara says a notary would always be forbidden because 3 days before, 3 days after, for Christians, right, notary is Jesus of Nazareth, you would do, Sunday would be every day their holiday, 3 days before, 3 days after, the whole week is shot. What we find out in passing is that the Gemara seems to treat Christianity, and this is a single passage, as Avodah Zarah. So the Gemara seems to treat it as such, but there's, again, very little discussion what is the definition of the type of theology, the type of belief that constitutes Avodah Zarah. Now here I believe it's important, if we want to take a step back and ask ourselves what is defined as Avodah Zarah, to focus on two different things. And they really derive from two different prohibitions in the Torah. They refer to the prohibition of Avodah Zarah. One is in the Aseret HaDibros. Lo yelecha l'chim achirim al panai. You shall have no other gods before me, the first source. Here I assume you all know that. You shall have no other gods before me. Now that is the prohibition of the worship of an other god. Consider the end of the pasuk. Ki anochi Hashem elokecha el kana. I am the Lord your God, a jealous God. The metaphor of a jealous God evokes what type of imagery? Like where else do we see the idea of somebody jealous in the Torah? You imagine, what imagery is it evoking? The husband is jealous, right, for the wife that is suspected of committing adultery, the Parsha of Sotah. The idea of God as the husband and Bnei Israel as the wife is a metaphor theme that appears in the Nevi'im. And the idea is that we are not keeping to our fidelity, betraying our fidelity by worshiping other gods. It actually uses this metaphor later when it refers to idolatry. It uses terms of sexual infidelity. They will fornicate after the other gods of the land. So we are betraying our relationship with God. We are giving our service to another god. That is the Avodah Zarah of the Aseret HaDibros. That is the worship of another god. Now, that is very different from the Avodah Zarah that we find in the Devarim. The Avodah Zarah mentioned in Dvarim, if you look at the second source, says the following, right, in Dvarim Dalad, Nishmartem Ol B'Nafsho Keichem, you should be very careful, Ki Lo Vitem Kol Tmina, V'Yom Diver Hashem Alechem B'Kor Yizmi Tocha Eish, you saw no image when God spoke to you, Pen Tashchitun V'Afitem Lachem Pesel Tmunat Kol Tzamel, Tamnit Zachar O Nekeva, lest you act corruptly and make for yourself an image, the image of any male or a female, and then you worship them. So what is the Torah warning against here? It's the warning against the worship of an other god. You saw no image at Har Sinai, and therefore, if you think you saw an image, that's a problem, because therefore you'll come to do what? Not worship another god, but what we come to do? Worship the image. Worship God through an image, right? And then that is a corruption, Pentash Bitun, a corruption of the worship of God. So it is not the worship of another being. It is a corrupt way of worshiping God, also representing God in physical form corrupts the idea of God. And worshiping God through something physical also is a corruption of the worship of God. That also is termed Avodah Zarah. It's actually interesting. I believe this is the key to understanding the parsha of the Egel, because the, you know, Mefarshim debate, was the Egel the worship of another God, or was it the attempt to replace Moshe Rabbeinu and to have some physical representation as a means, as a vehicle of worshiping God? And I believe that the key word is the word we find here, that, where it says, Pen Tashchitun. What does God say to Moshe? Lech Reib Maher Ki Shichet Amcha. They have corrupted. Not that they have worshipped another God, but they have corrupted the worship of God through creating an image. So these are the two forms of Avodah Zarah. Rambam lays this out quite clearly. Worship of an other being and the worship of God through images. So if we ask ourselves, why did the Rishonim who say that Christianity is Avodah Zarah, which was pretty much universally assumed outside of the Me'iri, why did they say this? They never tell us why they say it. They just assert it. Presumably, we could see, understand how it could fit into either of these two categories. Now, when you will hear sometimes people say, is Christianity Avodah Zarah, right? Sometimes the way they'll frame it is the idea of the Trinity polytheism or not polytheism, which again, very, very offensive to Christians. But there's no, Avodah Zarah is not defined as polytheism. That's not the halachic definition of Avodah Zarah. The halachic definition is the worship of an other god. And then the question becomes, is the other god, what makes God so different that it would be considered other? Right? So for example, the Rambam says, and this is why we're not going to talk about Moscow, right? The Rambam says that Islam is not a Avodah Zarah. It doesn't mean it's Judaism. It doesn't mean that you can convert to Islam. But it's not a Avodah Zarah. It's not the worship of another. First of all, they eschew all images. And second of all, they don't worship another god. Now, they tell a different story about God, right? God's prophet is Mohammed. God's chosen son is Ishmael. They tell a different story about God, but it's not a different God. So the question would become, how different does that idea of God have to be considered the worship of an other God? Would the idea of the Trinity be enough? That you could certainly understand why many would assume yes, that any idea of God that has that concept of the Trinity is so much a profoundly different concept, that that is the concept of an other God. There's other things as well, which of course can make the theology considered to be, focusing on the theology, not the worship, be the worship of an other god. What about their idea of God is also so fundamentally different than the core Jewish idea of God, in addition to the Trinity? Yes?
You've got worship of or veneration of icons.
Okay, so that's the form of worship, so we're going to get to that in a minute, but now I'm talking about purely about the belief, theology, not the worship, yes? Right, so the idea that God takes human form, right, which isn't something to be obviously a part of the idea of the Trinity, but that as well could be so fundamentally against the Jewish idea of God that that would be considered an other God. Now, I do want to point out, interestingly, that Rambam, who was very clear about in many, many ways that, you know, that Christianity is a Avodah Zarah, I still haven't pretty solved the problem about to put out there, which is the Rambam says, you know, that any idea about God, Rambam is also very clear about his dogma about what defines true faith. True belief in God. For Rambam, any idea that God has any sense of physicality or any sense of emotions, any of these things for Rambam is a basic corruption of the idea of God. He says it's worse than Avodah Zarah, but even though the Rambam says it's worse than Avodah Zarah, Rambam calls these things heresy. He never says that, let's say a Jew believes that God has a physical form, right? Rambam deals with Jews who believe God has a physical form. He calls them heretics. He never calls them Ovdei Avodah Zarah. So for some reason, although for the Rambam that is such a wrong idea of God, it's completely a category mistake for the Rambam to think about that. for some reason for him, that still is close enough that it's not a Bodhisattva, it's heresy. So it's an interesting question whether these ideas of Trinity and of incarnation would define the sense of other God. I think many of us intuitively would think it would, but on the other hand, you know, it's a belief of a single creator God, and that's a question, but presumably it would certainly, it seems that it would fall under that category. The second, and the maybe more obvious one, is what was said before, the other category of a Bodhisattva, the use of images in the worship of God. Now, one of the ways of testing this is how did the post can deal with Protestantism, right? So Protestantism doesn't use images. Did they still categorize that as a Bodhisattva? And they basically said yes, and they pointed to the Trinity. They pointed out that it wasn't as bad, it wasn't as the idea as the use of images, but that did not automatically mean that it was no longer defined as a Bodhisattva, so they went back to the sort of theology here, which is itself seen as problematic. And that's why, again, without them articulating it, it has been assumed, with the exception of the Mi'iri, which we'll get to, that Christianity is defined as a Bodhisattva. Now, you could imagine how somebody could disagree. They could say, as I said, it's still a basic belief in a creator God. Yes, there are these aspects of it which we think are totally wrong, but that doesn't mean that it's fundamentally a belief of a different God. And how about the use of the images? Well, it's possible that somebody could say that they don't really believe that the images, it's not like the old time, you know, the good old time religion, the good old time paganism, where they believe that somehow the divinity inhered within the image itself, but the images are aids in their worship of God, and they're not actually directly worshipped. So you could hear how that argument could be made, but it was not made for a good 1500 years or so. We find only very recently, or not since 1500 years, it's an overstatement, but we do find in some of the sources that we'll be seeing an attempt to reflect on those parameters. Okay, but that's what, but that's the basic lay of the land, that Christianity was assumed to be a Bodhisattva. Now we're going to get in a minute to theory, which I keep on referencing, which I think people are aware of or heard of. It's right now, it used to be like a very obscure opinion. Now it's everybody knows about it. But before we do, and before we introduce that, I want to talk about how this idea of labeling Christians as Ode Bodhisattva changed over time, not from any sort of philosophical pluralistic type of a perspective, but based on very real-world economic and societal realities. And this happened in the world of the Tosafot. Tosafot, 12th to 13th century in France, Germany, dealt with the problem that if you apply the label of a Bodhisattva to Christians, then so many restrictions in the Talmud that apply to Ode Bodhisattva would apply to Christians as well. Three in particular, that were dealt with were the following. One was not doing business with them on their holidays. If you can't do business with them on their holidays, then not 3 days before, 3 days after, we don't rule that way. But anyway, that would rule out Sunday. The big market day was Sunday. If Jews were involved in commerce and you can't buy and sell on the big market day, then you're out of business. So that created very serious problems. The second was the problem of going into business with them. The Gemara says you're not allowed to go into business with somebody who's an Ovid of Bodhisattva. Why? Because the way you kept people honest in the past was you had them take an oath in the name of their God that they did not cheat or do anything wrong, you know, with the funds. So what would happen if you have your business with a Christian and they take an oath in the name of their God or their saints? Would that be a problem or not? That was second issue. And the third issue, as we'll see, is actually Jews made a very good business, particularly this time of year, I kid you not, in selling Christian ritual objects. And was that permissible? Because you're not allowed to help non-Jews worship a Bodhisattva, and by selling them their ritual objects, if it's considered a Bodhisattva, you're helping them worship a Bodhisattva. These were three major areas. Now, Tosafot tried to find a way to solve these problems. Many people might not be aware, but that's a general sort of part of Tosafot's agenda, is when the Gemara conflicts with the established practice of his very observant Jewish community, then he had to find a way to reconcile that, and he found a way to bridge the gap and to find out how the observant community was not violating in their practices, and he finds a way to solve these problems, but he does it without recategorizing Christianity. So I want to review the way he solved these problems and then talk about how these types of ad hoc, or if you were, technical workarounds, are different than a more fundamental approach to redefine Christianity. So if you take a look, let's start here on source number 5. Okay, here's Tosfos talking about the issue about doing business. He says, the reason for the permission is that we know that our non-Jews, it's ironic, it's like, you know, Goyim Shabbeinu, but again, it was changed. It literally means our idolaters don't worship idolatry. But actually, the original text was our non-Jews don't worship, we know they don't worship idolatry. Now, some say, have a different text would say, we're not afraid that because they make money in the business, they'll thank their God, so it's not a concern of doing business with them on their holiday. What does this mean? This basically means that he makes a distinction between Christianity and Christians. And he adopts what I would say is a legal fiction. And he says, Christianity is avodah zarah, but Christians aren't so frum. Christians don't actually believe or are not really so totally sincere. In other places, the way this is framed is minhagav l'shem b'yadeihem. They just follow in the practices they've been brought up in. So they're not really very sincere or knowledgeable about the worship they're doing. So you can't call them ovdei avodah zarah. Christianity remains avodah zarah, but Christians, we can be very nice to them. We don't have to call them ovdei avodah zarah. Now, as a statement of historical fact, this is probably completely false. Probably if at any time people were very sort of frum and sincere about their worship, was in the Middle Ages. However, it provides for an ability to, you know, get around these restrictions by saying, well, we can just say that they really aren't so sincere about it, they're not really ovdei avodah zarah. The question I want to ask, and this is really a theme I want to focus on with two approaches that are going to have an impact when we deal with these churches, is the difference between developing a workaround answer like this, as opposed to just saying Christianity isn't avodah zarah. Why do you think Tosfos at this stage, why would he just say, if he's trying to solve this problem, so just say, look, Christianity isn't avodah zarah. Why does he say Christianity is avodah zarah, but Christians, they're not really so sincere about it, so it's not a problem, they're not okay with it. What's sort of the benefit of taking that approach as in a more of a fundamental redefinition? Or what would be the reason, if not the benefit, of taking that approach? Yes? Okay, well, I would say, in the first answer, I was wondering if somebody was going to say, because maybe I framed it as what would be the benefit. One explanation is, that's not a benefit, so let's just believe that Christianity was a avodah zarah. So he can say, well, let's prepare to redefine it. I mean, that's what we started with. It seems very clear it is, but he was able to adopt this type of a legal fiction. And that might very well be true. I assume that is true. But I think it's also worth noting, as was mentioned, that what you get by having this fiction is, this and not a fundamental redefinition, is you still keep Christianity and that faith as taboo. You still say, this is off limits. This is something we don't believe in. It doesn't mean we have to be mean to Christians, or actually wasn't about being mean, it was actually for the benefit of Jews, but it doesn't mean we have to deal with all of these restrictions. But we have to remember that this is not our faith, this is not a kosher theology, it's not a theology we believe in. You're talking about to prevent people from converting. I'm not sure if it's specifically converting, but we're still very much keeping the taboo of Christianity. And I think that that is exactly what you get by adopting this type of position of that it is forbidden, but it's the difference between Christianity and Christians. Okay, and this is really the approach that emerges from a number of Tosfos. So let's take a look at another one, number 7, where he deals with the issue of going into partnership with them. And here he says the following, source number 7. Mikan Oser Rabbeinu Shmuel Kabbalas HaShvuah Mikal V'Chomer. Based on this, that you can't go into business with Ovdei Avodah Zarah, Rabbeinu Shmuel says you can't take it, accept their oath. Rabbeinu Tam Mat, Rabbeinu Tam allows this. Then he says, Oh, here's Rabbeinu Tam. Nowadays, everybody takes an oath in the name of Kedeshim, their saints, and not in the name, and they don't consider their saints to be gods. So what he's saying is, an oath, it's not mentioning, the Gemara says it's forbidden because to have a non-Jew take an oath in the name of their god, because it says, Shem Elohim Achirim lo tazkiru lo yishamal picha. The name of the god, you cannot have cause to be said even by somebody else in the form of an oath. So it says when they take an oath in the name of Saint so-and-so, they don't treat that as a god. So that's not somebody taking an oath in the name of another god. And then he says, the covenant some was ever achir, but that's just 1 minute. They don't just say in the name of Saint so and so. They say in the name of God and Saint so and so. So they are saying God. Well, God is okay. We believe in God too. The problem is that they say God, they're thinking about something different than we think about when they think about. They're thinking about the Trinity, and they're thinking about, you know, God maybe in incarnate form. So is that mentioning the name of Elohim Achirim? The word is the same word we use, but what it refers to is something other. Is that a problem or not? The Tosfos says, Mikol Makom, in the shame of Avodas Kochavim, it's not the name of an Avodas Kochavim, he could have just said because the name is okay, but he goes on, when they say God, they're thinking about the creator of heaven and earth. So that's an idea that we can identify with. So they're okay. God is okay, and St. George is okay. St. George, they don't believe, is a God, and God refers to a similar idea of God that we have. This Tosfos is the one that makes at least the most strongest statement that in some fundamental ways we share an idea of God with Christians. He's not saying they're not over there, but we share an idea. He says, the Alpha Gav, and now comes his last question, Shemishtatev Shem Shemayim B'davar Acher, even though they combine the name of God with something else, Ein Tamitna Ivelosita Mishro, that's not putting a stumbling block by them because you're causing them, because they're saying an oath and they combine God with something else. His name Noach Lohuzer Alakach, Noachai, they're not prohibited against this. And for us, it's not a problem to cause them to join the name of God with something else. So what is this last point, that they join the name of God with something else? What do you think he's referring to here? That Christians join the name of God with something else. So the Trinity could mean something else, though. In the immediate context of the Tosfos, what else could it mean? No, that they join the name of God, they take an oath in the name of God, and saying so-and-so. That's what he's talking about before, right? So if ever, you know, if you ever, I remember the scene from Shakespeare from the Kenneth Brogner movie, Henry V, he's about to charge into the city, and he says, in the name of God and St. George, right? So that's the oath that they take. So you're combining God with something else, and the Gemara is very clear that in some type of religious service, you're not allowed to combine the name of God with something else. Like, for example, what we do on Sukkot, we say, Ani Bahu Hoshiana. And we have a whole problem, like it's I and God or whatever, what does that mean? And it calls that combining the name of God with something else in a religious context. So the simple meaning of this Tosfos is God and the name of the saint. And Tosfos says, that's not a problem for non-Jews. They can combine the name of God with other things. That's probably the original meaning of this Tosfos. So it's a technical workaround that the oath is okay. But, as was said, for many, many poskim have read this Tosfos to mean something else. Have read this Tosfos not to be the issue about how the oath is taken, but to be a fundamental question about Christian theology. That they combine the idea of God, the Osei Shamayim Ba'aretz, with other elements that we can't identify with, and isn't this a problem? Right? They believe in a different idea of God. There's those other things. That's not a problem for non-Jews. It's only a problem for Jews. And this then becomes a belief, a position of many, many, many poskim that is called B'nei Noach Lohuzeru Avashitu. Non-Jews, Noachites, are not prohibited against a combination belief, believing in a fundamental, supreme, transcendent creator of heaven and earth with other elements that we wouldn't necessarily agree with. That is no problem for us. It's not a problem for non-Jews. This becomes a widely accepted position. When I was growing up, I was always told this. I don't know who else is this, but I was always told this. Christianity is a vote of Zara for Jews, not for non-Jews. And that becomes a widely accepted position. This actually is used by the Ramah, and the Shach explains it this way, about the third area I spoke about selling ritual objects to non-Jews. The Ramah says you can sell ritual objects to non-Jews, you know, that they even that the priests will use. And the Shach, and why is this? He refers to another ruling about going into business with them, what we just saw, and the Shach says, because for them it's not Avodah Zarah. So you're not helping them do Avodah Zarah. It's only Avodah Zarah for us. It's not Avodah Zarah for them. So this becomes now another position, which is that it's Avodah Zarah for Jews, not for non-Jews. Now, I want to again reflect on what are the implications of this position. Now, notice again, Tosfos is not coming from an ideological position. He's trying to solve a real-world challenge. But he does it by saying two things. Either Christianity is is Avodah Zarah, but Christians aren't really sincere about it. And here he's saying that it's not Avodah Zarah for them, it's Avodah Zarah for us. Both of them maintain, again, he's probably saying this because he's not prepared to say, in principle, not just for the practical benefits, but from a theological position, he's not prepared to say it's not Avodah Zarah. But, and the practical implications of this is, it maintains the idea of Christianity as a taboo, as this, or that theology, this, as something that is not a Jewish theology. It's clearly a theology that is against our theology. There's no question about that. But what it does is, it allows for full interaction with them. They're not really okay, Avodah Zarah. For them, it's not a problem. It solves the practical issues, but it leaves the principle in place. That's what's accomplished by Tosfos. And I do want to point out the benefit of moving from the first position to the second. The first position is very much similar, parallel to a position, another sort of the position they're not really sincere about it, to another type of strategy for inclusion that you find nowadays for non-religious Jews. What's the basic strategy for inclusion for non-religious Jews? Does anyone know? Aren't they Mechalei Shabbos? The answer is Dino Kshenishpa, right? Oh, they're not really responsible for their actions. They really don't really know what they're doing. So it's very nice that we've now solved the problem, but we've done it by sort of infantilizing and dismissing them. And the same is really true about, you take these very sincere Christians, we can be nice to you because you really aren't sincere and frum about your own religious beliefs. There's something sort of deeply problematic with that, in addition, by the way, of often being factually incorrect. The other approach is actually much better in that regard. It's saying, we are not saying that you're Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Your standards are not the same as our standards. And actually, there is something that is quite nice about it. Because the larger theme, and as I was introduced, it was said that we're going to get to practical, so don't worry, we are. But the larger theme that I wanted to bring out here tonight is what I see as a question about all these issues around inclusion, is striking the balance between inclusion and boundaries, or if you want, say it a different way, between pluralism and relativism. Right? How can we sort of be very pluralistic and say, I respect, your commitments and your faith, and, you should respect mine? And at what stage does that become, well, everybody's just totally personal choice? In the end, we don't really believe anything is true. Right? I mean, I really do believe that Trump is nice to you, that's tolerance. But if we want to go beyond tolerance, we want to be more pluralistic and accept that for you, this is true, for me, something else is true, where's the line between pluralism and relativism? And I think Tosfos does it in a brilliant way. Tosfos said, I mean, that's not what he was intending, it's not Tosfos. The way Tosfos has been read is that for Jews, there's one definition of belief, and for non-Jews is another, so for you it's totally fine, and for us it's not okay, so we can't judge you, you're not doing anything wrong, but for us it really is totally not acceptable. Of course, I made it a little nicer than it is, because it's not really pluralism, right? Because really what we're saying is that for non-Jews, it's not just a different standard, right? It's what is it?
Lower.
It's a lower standard. We're not going to be as exacting on you. When I was speaking to David before the lecture, and I was telling him about this, he said, oh, like the mashgiach that won't eat at the restaurant and gives the hashgacha to. For you, it's okay. For me, I will not. I'm going to use that again next time I give this lecture. I appreciate that. So anyway, but I realize it has that problem, but at least that's what you are in Tosfos' world. You have Christianity is still a theology we can't accept, but we're going to be work together with Christians. We're not going to be, we might even, as Tosfos gets read later, not even really say that they're okay of Avodah Zarah, they have a different standard. And I do think that the reason, this is a clear misreading of Tosfos, let's just be clear about that, although the post can debate it, but it seems very clear that it is. I think the reason that it caught on was not only because it allowed posting to deal with practical questions, but I think that there was something that really resonated about that. About how do you keep on going and labeling Christians as Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and as, we became more into the modern period, there was something I would like to believe that sort of resonated with that type of an approach as opposed to the others. Now, this is to be contrasted with the approach of the Meiri. As you can see, we're only very selectively reading the sources for the sake of time. It's a whole big, it's like a mini book here. So anyway, you can look at them more at more leisure at home. The Meiri takes a position that Christianity is not Avodah Zarah. The Meiri says that, not only that, because really any of these religions that believe in a God, he says, even if they are religions that are very distant from our belief, if they believe in a transcendent moral God, then it is not a bodhisattva. He doesn't even address the question that they question about incarnation and Trinity and the use of images. He just says a belief in a transcendent God that's not a bodhisattva is fundamentally different from the past when, you know, there was a real belief in gods that were under nature, not gods that were over nature. And then he applies this across the board. Basically, you know, we said at the beginning that when the Jews censored their own work and said, all these things about non-Jews, they don't apply to you, they only apply to those ancient pagans, those Ovdei Kohavim and Mazalos. That's really what the Meiri says. All the times in the Gemara that you have these statements about non-Jews, they all apply to ancient pagans. Nowadays, none of the non-Jews among us are Ovdei Avodah Zarah. One doesn't know what exactly he can do with Hinduism, that's probably another discussion. But anyway, that is the position of the Meiri. I want to just read one line of it, because then I want to talk about these two as competing approaches. Okay, so he said, if you want to take a look, I have a couple of sources of the Meiri, and we'll just pick out one of them. Let's look at number 10. He says like this, Harber Inu is on page 3. Nobody is careful about these prohibitions relating to Christians, relating to Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Hanukarbi anu eagers of anasa sefer eze uma disavevet. Who are the people it's referring to? Those were the early people that were not careful about in ways of religion, were not committed to, sort of constrained by religious ways. That they would worship really the stars and constellations and talismans. That's real idolatry. Nowadays, it's all basically monotheism, and you can't call any of this Avodah Zarah. That is the Meiri's approach. Now, I want to talk about how the Meiri has been accepted with halacha, and then turn to the question about how this will apply to churches. So, there are, I would say, in the past, prior to the last 20 years, first of all, a lot of the Meiri's writings weren't known. But even beyond that, prior to the past 20 years, you would find occasionally the Meiri coming up. But the Meiri would come up in the postkin every now and then when it would, you know, the more modern ones with more modern sensibilities, in the following way. They would very, very rare, if ever, quote him in a tshuva, in a formal tshuva. They would usually talk about him in a letter. You have a letter of Rav Kook, which we'll look at. You have a letter Rav Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, that would say you have to go like the Meiri is right. They would say this in a letter, but then when they wrote Tshuvot, where they could have used the Meiri, they found other ways to come to the same conclusion without quoting the Meiri. And the reason is because the Meiri is a radical reread of the earlier sources, of 1,000 or 1,500 years of precedent and the way the sources have been interpreted. And it was very challenging, you know, to the system. The Halachic system is a very conservative system. You don't sort of totally change its assumptions overnight. And to totally reread all of that was very hard to do as a part of a natural part of the Halachic process. So while they, in principle, wanted to go by the Meiri, they were reluctant to use the Meiri explicitly. I will say that I've seen things change in the last 10 or 20 years. More and more you see what, again, I would call posting with a modern sensibility, particularly posting writing in Eretz Yisrael and dealing with the issues of sort of democracy in the land of Israel, where they really have to incorporate these types of sensibilities. And you see them more using the Meiri in Tshuvot and in articles and really embracing it. So that's point number one, that there's been an evolution. But the important point that I want to get to turn to our issue is even those that quote the Meiri, in what areas do they quote the Meiri? And let's take a look now at source 14 from a letter of Rav Kook. Okay? And the letter of Rav Kook says the following. He says, Sha'ikar hu kidak ha-Meiri, the real print ruling is like the Meiri. Shekol ha-Mim shem gedurim b'nivisim ha-Gonim, all nations that are constrained by ethical laws, religious ethics, Meiri did not believe in secular ethics, Ben Adamu Chaveiro, and Kvar Nachshavim Legevim Toshavim, they would be considered like a Ger Toshav, meaning not an idolater, an Ovid of Rezara, V'chol Chiyuvei Ha'adam, regarding all issues of human rights and responsibilities. And even if we say like the other poskim, and then he goes on. And this, I believe, is the key to understanding a lot of the poskim who embrace the Meiri, do not embrace them across the board. They embrace him. There are really two categories of halachot that divide between Jews and non-Jews. There are more, but for our purposes, we'll mention two. There are those that have to do with ethical treatment of the other. Have questions about, you know, the Gemara discusses, can you steal from a non-Jew? Now, by the way, you really know a topic is problematic when the censorship, it's not enough to say akum, it has to make it even different. So the Gemara that discusses, can you steal from a non-Jew? If you open up your Gemara Baba Kama, you will not see the question about Gezel Goy, you won't even see the question about Gezel Akum, you'll see the question about Gezel Knani. Can you steal from a Canaanite? Is the question in the Gemara. What?
So that's it's only for
Khan,
and that's why
it's okay. Right, it's only for those ancient Canaanites. Nobody would ever have that thought about nowadays. Of course, right. Of course, actually, the correct Kirs in the Gemara, that the Rishonim have is Gezel Goy. Okay, so there's a question, can you steal? Do you have to return their lost objects? Do you have to pay are you allowed to damage them? Do you have to pay if they've been damaged? All these basic issues of civil law and ethical responsibilities. That's one whole category. And the other category are the things that really have to do with the faith and the religion. Can you go into their house of worship? Can you do business with them on their holidays? You know, all these questions that have to do with the religion itself. By and large, the posting nowadays that are adopting the Meiri are like Rav Kook. He says, "B'chol chiyuvei ha'adam." They adopt him in the first category, the category of ethics. There's a very overwhelming, I think, moral resentment, you know, moral responsibility to sort of to eliminate these types of distinctions, and that's where you feel that they really feel this ethical imperative to get to a position like the Meiri or to embrace the Meiri. It is much, much rarer that you will find this in the issues about the religion per se. And I believe it's for the reason that we said, that there is an important sort of theological issue going on here. It's one thing to say we treat them as equal human beings and equal rights and responsibilities and so on. It's another thing to say we see their religion as somehow not a foreign religion. And what does that do to our own sense of our own commitment and our own religious commitment? So that's where you find it much less. And the two sources I have here, a couple of sources, again, you know, you can look more detailed here. Hagola talks very much about ethically we have to remove all distinctions. He says here, let's just see maybe the second paragraph on source 15. I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to translate it. He says, the Elo HaGoyim Asher Nachnu Uma Yisrael Yisgolim V'Tzeu Shelahem Umifazarim Deinehem They believe in the creation of the world and the exodus and the fundamentals of faith, some of them. They believe, fundamentally, they're believing in a creator God. Those without saying that there's no prohibition against saving them. We have to pray for their well-being. The Seder Haggadah Pesach, the Pesach, good topic to have that discussion on. It's like the somebody said, you know, the interfaith seder with translation. Love thy neighbor as thyself. So that's where he gives his commentary. Okay, so it goes on like this. So that's where you'll find it in the vast majority of times, and it raises the issue about, there are some exceptions, and it does raise the issue about, you know, the theology. And that's the point that I want to stop about and talk, and again, just reflect before we get to the practical application about the churches. Because, you know, I do think that particularly a challenge for us nowadays is that we're very good at the forms of Yiddishkeit. We're very good at halacha and Talmud Torah and so on. I think probably particularly for the modern Greek Orthodox community, you know, the issue about emuna, you know, really sort of, you know, having like a sort of a deep belief for many people is very challenging, and something that For many of us, it can be a lifestyle and a commitment, but not something in which the emunah issue plays that big of a role. And I think that if it was ever true in the past, it's all the more true right now. The quest, you know, the challenge that arises by saying, okay, we're going to embrace the Me'iri by, you know, by the issue about not only about interpersonal relations, but also we're going to say Christianity is not a bodhisattva. And, you know, in the end, they believe in God, we believe in God. The differences are not enough to label it as some type of problematic theology that we would call it a bodhisattva. My fear is, and I'm also talking personally and why I think the poskim aren't saying this, is some of the poskim, I'm saying for the practical issues, the poskim might have said that on the principle. A, they do see it as a fundamental, you know, other type of belief, an anathema to Jewish belief. And I'm also talking about the practical implications that I see a real fear that we have enough of challenges in terms of emunah issues, and if we don't have any sense of boundaries and any sense of taboo, then it just further erodes our sort of, you know, Judaism becomes a lifestyle and not a religious faith and a religious commitment. So those are where my concerns are, and at the same time I recognize that a bodhisattva is not a value-neutral label. It's not just saying it's a theology we reject. Even I can spend the whole hour here saying a bodhisattva means foreign worship and it doesn't mean idolatry, and it's not going to change the fact that a bodhisattva has a lot of extremely negative connotations, extremely negative baggage, and to talk, you know, about, you know, Christians as ode a bodhisattva is not sort of in value-neutral terms. So I don't know what the complete solution to that is. But I do want to say, and with this we're going to look at the question about going into churches finally, is that that's what I think is at stake here. There are two approaches to the going into churches question. One approach is to say, let's just embrace the Me'iri and say that it's not a bodhisattva and that it's okay, you can go into churches, end of story. The other approach is to say, no, we're going to, A, because maybe, you know, you can't just introduce the Me'iri this late into the game, or for whatever reason, or for the more other practical reasons I suggested, we're not prepared to say Christianity is not a bodhisattva, but we'll try to solve the practical problem the way Tosus did. We'll look at all the details, and we'll see if there's some form of a workaround. Maybe sometimes the answer is going to be no, maybe sometimes the answer will be yes, so it won't be as permissive, but the end result, what we're doing is we're keeping sort of the grappling with the reality that this is a faith that is, you know, very different from the Jewish faith and a problematic faith from our perspective. Not like we're going to judge them, you know, different standards, but that from our perspective, a problematic faith, and it requires grappling, and sometimes the answer is going to be no because it is problematic. And that's the approach that I actually think is a sort of, in terms of a values and a principle perspective, the more correct approach, and also B, I think it's much more in keeping with, you know, the entire tradition of Psak Halacha on this matter, which has treated it this way and has found workarounds and has found ways of attenuating the problem, but has not fundamentally, you know, with the exception of the Me'iri, taken it off the books, and even those that embrace the Me'iri don't always do so fully. Now, that being said, I want to give a contrast to this about another question, which is about, let's talk about the ethical issues for a minute, about the Me'iri. Saving the life of a non-Jew on Shabbos. Okay? How are we allowed to do that? According to the Gemara in principle, you shouldn't do it. So, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, you're allowed to do it because if you don't save the life of a non-Jew, you're going to put Jewish lives at risk. That it'll be, you know, people will lead to pogroms and it'll lead to, you know, lead to terrible things and so on, and therefore, you're allowed to save the life because it'll put Jewish lives at risk. And Miri says, the principle you're allowed to save the life of a non-Jew, that only applies to those ancient pagans. Now, because halacha does not like such radical change, as I said, mostly poskim have adopted Rav Moshe's justification and not the Me'iri's, even though this is an ethical issue. Now here, there are some real problems with that. The real problems are that I know stories about hatzalah, you know, that will sometimes choose not all. Some hatzalahs have been very clearly guided that it doesn't matter who calls and so on Shabbos, you answer regardless. But there are some hatzalahs that say, well, since it's only based on Rav Moshe and who causes this to Jews, and sometimes we won't answer and we know that, you know, nobody will know and it won't be a risk that they won't answer certain calls from non-Jews on Shabbos. So that's what happens if you use Rav Moshe's justification and not a principal position of the Me'iri. So there is a...
You would be able to take them on Tuesday if you reject them.
Well, that might be about Avodah Zarah and so on and real Avodah... Well, okay, yes, that's true as well. But the point is The point I want to make is that there, I think the same way Rav Kook said, and more quotes him, as I've mentioned, are saying, there I see a real ethical imperative to embrace Tamiri, even though it is introducing a new sort of approach within the system, but there, because there are real negative consequences to having workarounds in those ethical areas, because you'll always find a reason to cheat on your taxes, or to not answer the call, or to not do this, if it's all debatable. As opposed to the issue by the churches, where they're actually, I think, two things. Number one is that there really goes to the definition of avodah zara. The other things don't have to the same degree. The halachic history on that is much clearer, is much more explicit. And as I've said, my position is that in principle, I think that it's important that we maintain some sense of limits and taboos and so on in terms of theological areas, because I think that's an issue that's challenged enough, you know, where we stand as a community. So now I want to turn to the church question, but I'll take a question or two because I've been talking nonstop. Yes. Right. Absolutely, and that is exactly along the lines of what I'm suggesting as the approach. I mean, rather than just saying blanket, adopt the Meiri, no question, say no, it is a problem. But first of all, Christianity now is not what it was then, it's not exactly the same, it's a lower level, and therefore, not, you know, we can find ways in a lot of cases to sort of figure out a solution. So that, I think, is exactly the grappling, which is we're going to recognize that there is something problematic here, but we're also going to recognize it's not as problematic as paganism, and it's not as whatever, and, you know, and that we're going to get into the sort of nitty-gritty of the halakhic issues, and maybe sometimes come out to say it's permissible, maybe sometimes we won't be able to say it, but that is exactly the approach that I'm recommending, and that's what we're going to look at in a minute. Yes?
Rabbi Linzer, can I just have a question about how you read the Barakola?
Yes.
Are you not reading him to say that Christianity is not a avodah zarah? Forget about whether he agrees with the Meir across the book, because he's talking about Christian belief here. He's saying that all covenants on...
My question is, when you say that, right.
So it seems to me that he's not talking about the status of Christians, but he's talking about the nature of Christian belief.
Yes, but again, I would say that you have to read all of, whenever they say this, you know, read them closely, what are the practical implications they're drawing? And a lot of times, the only practical implications they're drawing are about issues about sort of, you know, their rights. And again, if you adopt the explanation of Shituf is the sort of logic, so yes, there are some problematic aspects, that's Shituf, that's a problem, that's not a problem for them, it's only a problem for us, but again, it would not mean that you could walk into a church, because a church is, if it's for us it's avodah zarah, it's still a problem. So yes, he's saying they're not avodah zarah from their definition, but it doesn't mean, like the Meiri, that even from our perspective it's not avodah zarah. That's exactly
right.
The difference.
That's the problematic aspect of the Meiri. It's not so much that he recategorized Christianity, but he said that even for Jews...
Exactly,
but
yes.
It seems to me that the Barakola, and it's just not a wide group of Poskim, it's the majority of Achronim read to say that Christianity
I agree with that for Christians.
Right.
But thank you for clarifying that point. If we adopt a read that that there's a different standard for Christians and for Jews, saying for Christians are not Ovdei Avodah Zarah, but for us such belief is Avodah Zarah, and the test case is going into churches. For them it's okay, but for us we should go by our standards, and that would be the test case. Now I want to give you two interesting examples about this trade-off, about just across the board not a problem, as opposed to let's sort of grapple with the problems and maybe come up with a solution. So take a look here. Let's start by the one that adopted the Meiri before he even knew of the Meiri. Source number 17, historical record of Rav Yosef Kalbach from Germany. And this is in a very reputable historical work called Frankfurt on the Hudson. And here's what it said. This liberal attitude towards secular culture took forms in German Orthodoxy that were inconceivable in Eastern Europe. One memoir tells of the excursions of high school students that the Orthodox rabbi, Reb Yosef Karlbach, was a bit more liberal than the Breuer family, led to the Rhineland. He spent a full day with the boys in the Cathedral of Cologne, expertly explaining every detail of the statues, the glass windows, the ornaments, and the intricacies of the Catholic faith and ritual. But I was not allowed to participate, being a Kohen, who may not be under the same roof with the court, or with whom. So that's what the writer of this memoir said. And in the footnote, here he goes on to, the author quotes the remainder of the memoir. Chaim Cohen, Yosef Karlbach. Cohen continues, I relate this episode because I think it's significant for the portrait of the man. On the one hand, the freedom from preconceived notions of the inaccessibility of non-Jewish places of worship and non-Jewish ritual art. And on the other hand, the strict and unbending adherence to the letter of the Jewish law, no matter how meaningless it may appear to the gospel, right? When questioned about the manifest discrimination between the injunctions he honored and the injunctions he disregarded, he would readily reply that the prohibitions relating to non-Jewish places and articles of worship applied only to heathen and not to theistic religions, and that any later extensions were prompted by the then-justified fear of conversion to Christianity, a fear that no longer existed. So here he channeled the Meiri without knowing it. Most of Meiri's writings were not known until about 70 years ago. And he basically said, yes, Christians are not Obdei Avodah Zarah, and it doesn't apply. The churches is not Avodah Zarah, and no problem going into their houses of worship. Now, contrast that, turn back the page to source on page 4, to source number 16, a beautiful little article by Rav Yitzchak Herzog, which appeared in Tchumim, in one of the first volumes, about how to justify, according to halacha, the rights of minorities, of minority religions in the state of Israel. And then so Islam is easy, but then he turns to Christianity, the Mazar, and so on. And here's what he says in the second paragraph. Again, my apologies for the lack of translation. So he says like this, the bottom paragraph with the Zion, where it says, Sovlanut hapuchan shel notrim, which is tolerating, thank you, tolerating the Christian worship. Protestant, even in the worst case, and most it's the Trinity, they use no statues, El Hashesi Ba'er Bavad, just the cross. The Zebar Ursha Eno El Semel is the Haron, that's only for remembrance, well Neva, they don't worship it. Aval Gam HaKatolim, Catholics, Yadua Lanu, She'enam Ovdim Landartot Betor Elohut. So here we go, right, similar to the point we said before, they use statues, but they don't really believe that, like, God inheres in the statue. It causes them to venerate, right, the people that are represented in the statues. The inti badash anu mitzuvim hitrachet mi lachanech from komot hatfilah shalhem to shem shasur lanu hashitov. Certainly, we can't go into those places of worship. The kol kol avizrayim shashitov, all these things that are related to the Trinity. The drachit tachli tamichok, the greatest of distance. Here the question is, do we have to prevent this worship in the Jewish state? And there we could say we don't have to prevent it because it's not so bad and it's not real Avodah Zarah and so on. So here he's willing to say, you know, the use of images is not the same as pagan, but again, notice he's drawing the line. I'm not to say that I want to lower the boundary and say it's totally okay for Jews, but just I want to say that it's totally okay for them, and even though we have a Jewish state, right, we can allow that to continue within a Jewish state. So you see that he's not willing to totally efface the differences, like say it's not problematic at all, but he works with the details and he gets to the conclusion he's interested in getting to. So now we're going to turn, he does not let them go into churches. So now we have to turn to the question of going into churches, and I realize the hour is late, so we're going to have to do this without, I'll try to, probably most of the sources outside. Sometimes this happens to me in a class I'm giving, I realize what time it is and how much I have left to cover. I told my students that, not too many of them share this, the background of that, but I used to read Mad Magazine, remember Dave Berg, The Lighter Side Of? So he once had The Lighter Side of Tourism. So he has that the tourist guide is like with this group and they're in Paris, and he says, okay, we're running a little behind schedule. You know, we only have an hour here in the Louvre, so remember, no looking. So hopefully it won't be that bad. Let me sort of summarize what the issues are about going into a Beis Avodah Zarah and how this issue has and could be applied to the Christian context. There are three problems that come up in the Gemara. The Gemara talks about going to a Beis Avodah Zarah. Three problems. One, the Gemara says, is a problem that the danger that it represents. It'll lead you astray. And quote the Pasuk, Harchek Me'alev Darcheka, keep your path away from it. You know, it says that's about heresy and about Avodah Zarah. If you go near it, it'll lead you astray. That's one issue, which is not like, although it's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, you know, often it's many assume that that's very, very weighty, but many also assume that that's a pragmatic concern and could depend on the context. That's one area. Just to sort of see how that area gets divided. Take a look here, compare on the bottom of page 6, a Shuvah of Rav Moshe to this issue, and a letter that from Rav Eliezer Berkowitz. So Rav Moshe on the bottom of page 6, and Rechaim has a question. Can kill and plague with the, you know, ball, ulam hashayach letisla da'akum, sort of in a hall or a yard near a church, or attached to a church. Vaday asur, certainly forbidden. Asha insham surot, even if there's no images, darchek me'ale, darcheka, distance your path from it. See, zoominut, min babazara, dafid zayin, that's heresy, vamesitim, vamidichim, vahem hardei, those that will push these kids off their path, the danger is great. Vinim taim sham biyoter, they're right there in the church. Va'adar al yeshu lamegli yolim ki drachakum ishach. You should, the opposite, teach them to stay away from there. V'shu makom v'shu katsu v'shu av. It is an abominable and disgusting place. The Ashit Sarich Zele Ezel Tamatara, even though a cheder needs this, a yeshiva needs this, Ein Lahatir, you can allow it, Ubiyotar Ketzef Yesigwe Zemakom, spend some more money, find another place, absolutely stay away. That's for a promotion. Contrast that to this letter of Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, who actually deals with entering a church, and he actually says it's permissible. This is a letter that actually unpublished, that will be published any day now. Dr. Mark Shapiro has put out is bringing this to publication, and it's coming out in Chove Journal Milin Chavivin. So stay tuned, it is about to be published. So here's a section of it, and here's what he says. If you were to be concerned about, you know, people will be influenced by the glory, we have conquered the desire for Avodah Zarah many generations ago, the yearning, seduction of Christianity, particularly regarding Christianity, that we suffered over hundreds of years. Most people don't even have the slightest inclination, like, oh my God, we're going to be led astray by Christianity. And I think, and he goes on in this way, and you can look at it, it's quite a fascinating letter, but I think that that's an accurate description. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't not some, you know, it would be much more concerned about having people read Jews for Jesus literature, or certain sort of, you know, missionaries, that really there is a very serious concern, but you're going into churches and you're looking at the art, that we think anybody nowadays, that that's going to somehow lead people astray, is very far-fetched. And the question is that, are you prepared to look at this concern, where it will lead, as a strict halacha, or something that really we can take a sort of a level-headed context approach to it? And clearly there are many poskim that will just really just totally embrace this. It's dangerous, it's usher, just stay away. And there are others that say, you know, recognize, come on, nowadays that's not so much the issue. And don't even really quote that so much when they deal with the question of going into Turkey. So that's one question. There are two other questions. The second question is a Maris Ayin question. Will it look that you're going to worship if you're going there? That's the second question. There's Gemara that discusses it. I'll get back to that in a minute. And there's a third question, which is the question about hana'ah, deriving benefit. So Gemara says that if you have a house that you brought into it, an avodah zarah, by this I mean an actual idol that was worshipped, then the house is considered to be a neshamshei avodah zarah, an appurtenance to the idol, an extension to the idol, and therefore the same way the idol is forbidden in benefit, the house also becomes forbidden in benefit. So if you consider the objects that people cross themselves in front of and kneel before those statues as objects of worship, then they're forbidden in benefit, and then the house as well becomes, the church and the sanctuary at least, becomes forbidden in benefit. These are the two. Now, I'm going to get to the issue of Maris Ayin in a minute, but I want to say something that is quite striking, which I don't think has been pointed out. If you look at the poskim, we deal with question about going into churches, Some of them discuss this issue about deriving benefit. It's an asur bahana, it's part connected to an idol and so on, and they really grapple with that. That's very serious. That's a biblical prohibition related to avodah zarah. That's like the most severe. But what's fascinating is that a number of poskim don't deal with it at all. Take, for example, Rav Avadi Yosef. When Rav Avadi Yosef was asked, can you go into a church? He basically says, absolutely not, not even if like the head of state of Israel needs to do it for some purposes of, you know, for political reasons. It's absolutely forbidden. And why? And he quotes the issue about the Maris Ayin, the Gemara's relating to the Maris Ayin, and he does not quote this Gemara about it being forbidden in benefit. Not only that, when he quotes an Achron that says that it's a biblical prohibition to go into a church, he says, well, maybe he's getting it from the pasuk, harcheka lat me'ala darcheha, but it's not really biblical, it's really only rabbinic, and the entire tshuva, although he concludes that it's forbidden, he assumes that it's rabbinic, and he doesn't quote this issue about the forbidden benefit at all, which is quite surprising. And it's quite surprising in particular if you consider the fact that the poskim did by and large assume, at least the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramon, the Shach, or whatever, that the objects of worship of Christians were like classic avodah zarah idols, which were prohibited in benefit. For example, the Ramah says that, he said, it's actually an interesting Ramah, he says, if they have a selim shemishtachavim lo, then it's forbidden in benefit. So if you read the Ramah in our printed edition, it just says an idol that they worship is forbidden. Of course an idol that they worship is forbidden. It's a tautology. It's again a problem of the censor, because the original text said, Shefi the Erev, Shemishtacha Vimbo, is Asur Behana. That when they bow down, if actually they direct their worship to a crucifix, then that is forbidden in benefit. That is like an idol. So that got again sort of censored out. But that is the position, and this is said in the Shach and in a number of classic poskim that these objects of worship. So why are the poskim, when they're dealing with the problem of going into a church, not mentioning this? I don't know for sure the answer, but I'll tell you what I think. I think that even with this strong attitude that Christianity is up to Zara, you have to distance yourself from it and so on, at some intuitive level, maybe there's a feeling that nowadays it really is hard to say that we would treat these objects like idols. You know, it's one thing to say we've got a problem with the Trinity and we've got a problem with, you know, with incarnation, we've got a problem with the use of images, but to say that these become objects of worship, these are like classic pagan idols, that these become avodah zarah, right, that I think is something that maybe it's some, I'm just totally speculating here, but that maybe is hard to say, and we actually do find a couple of poskim that say that point. So I want to point this out to you, that you can't call it avodah zarah. If you turn towards the object I'm talking about, not the faith, if you turn towards, going to skip a lot of pages here, okay, let's take a look on page 14, try to wrap up very soon, I know it's late. So here the Shulchan Aruch will first resource number 12, okay? Here's the Ramah that assumes it is, because he wrote images, and again, the original text is, which is quoted by all the poskim, Shefi Ve'erev, the crucifix, Shemishtachavim Lahem, that is sat down, Dinam Kedin HaTzelem, as like an idol that's worshipped, that's suing the Lobito, and is prohibited unless it is nullified. Okay, there are other sources here that say it as well. But look at now some contrary voices. Turns out,
pre-war Polish Yiddish,
yes,
the crucifix was called Salem.
Oh, that's interesting. So maybe that's why it was Salem there. But in the Darchei Moshe, he says explicitly Shefi Ve'erev. And when the line is quoted by their post, they quoted it as Shefi Ve'erev.
I'm not really focusing on that, but I'm right. saying that I think that the community...
Oh, the community, I see your point. The community is just the whole... Right, it is very much treating this as like an idol, right? A yes, like, right? say, right. So that's an interesting point, yes. So now we'll go at some other voices about this. Turn back to page 10, read Rabbeinu Yerucha on the Rishon, and listen to what he says. He's talking about finding vessels that have, like, pictures on them. The Ezar, he says, Goyim Shalanu, She'inim Adukin Vavodah Zarah, our non-Jews who are not, don't cleave to idolatry. Now, what does he mean? In the past, I said that was patronized. Back to page 13, so it's number 10. I'm sorry. I went back. He talks about our Christians don't cleave to idolatry. So before I said, you're telling them they're not strong. But now, in this context, context, I think it might mean something else. I think it might mean it's not classic about, you know, I'm saying idolatry instead of avodah zarah. That's what we're talking about, the worship making it an idol. It's not real idolatry. It's not really treating it as an idol. So he says, "Kol ma she'osim b'kelim, so it's isha ubina, madonna, and child, otsur shesi v'erev, or the crucifix, the adam talui alav, right, and a person crucified on it, einu asuyim ela lenoi, are only made for ornament, umutarim b'ana kulam." Now he might be saying you shouldn't assume they're worshipped. If you find it as on some type of a vessel, you should assume it's decorative, and you shouldn't assume it's worshipped. Yes.
With the Ramah?
With the Ramah? No. So he's distinguishing between those that are some are ornamental, some are worshipped, and right. Rabbi Yerucham might be saying no, nothing more than that.
Right.
That is correct. But now look at two other shuvot, back to page 14, contemporary shuvot. One from Yehuda Ya'aleh, Hungary's 19th century. Here's what he says. Adavar shebimkomo, in your place, title page 14, v'hamonim b'shar shemitzavavim b'yomei dam, that the priests and the masses, you know, go out on their holidays. This is Easter. They're an Easter sort of a procession. Tuchav chosana b'shabbat shebitochim ha'pesach, right, so the Easter. B'tzlamim u'psalim u'mechabdim oso b'urim, right, with images and idols, and they honor it with lights. And the Jews are forced to participate. So he says, so he talks about the issue, and then he says the following. The Gamizman Hazeh, Lo Ovdi Avodah Zarah, nowadays they're not real Ovdi Avodah Zarah. Lo Mikri Elil Shalahem Akum. So their object is not really, their image is not called an idol. And he refers to a shop. The shop says the opposite, so okay. But he says, it's not real Ovdi Avodah Zarah, it's not an idol, meaning that I believe that they don't actually, create that as an actual object of worship. This is most explicit in the following shuvah here of Yassel Avdi, Rav Avadya Hoda'a, which is a Sephardi posik that Rav Avadya Yosef likes to quote. And here's what he says. Bashir nistapakten, you had a question, al davar beit knesset ha-gadot sheba Singapore, shabo zarn b'chil luha, this is actually connects to the Hanukkah theme. It's a discussion in the Gemara when the Greeks entered into the temple, they desecrated it. They took out all the Sefer Torah. They put it in an image of that man, right, of Jesus, with flamin and so on. So he says the following. Regarding the sanctity of the synagogue, now that it's been retaken by Jews, the sanctity remains. And he brings other cases where people, used a show for idolatry and they left, and then the show retained its kedusha. And then he says, from that, it's certainly true in our case, since it was true in other cases. They do not really worship avodah zarah, meaning idols. They only put their statues in their churches as a aid, as a tool, as a remembrance, and not really as an object to be worshipped. The avoda was not to be worshipped. There's no concern. And from here we find something that I think is sometimes comes up in the posting. When they have to have a reason to say it's not really a avodah zarah, or it's not really, then they will find a way to make a distinction. They will not say that when the question is, am I allowed to go into a church? When the question was, can I now reclaim this shul and use it as a shul again, then you will have a statement like this, which is that, well, it wasn't really, they don't really worship that image anyway. It's not such a problem. I have not seen that argument quoted in the context of is it allowed to go into a church itself? So that's one issue I think to question, which is you do see post-him, not directly about going into church, but when they're talking about other things, sort of realizing how much are they really worshiping these objects. Now this, by the way, is an interesting question as well for, Catholic theologians, because, the principle that Catholicism lays down is exactly this, that these are for helping people, for veneration, not for adoration, not to be worshipped, You focus on God. You don't direct your worship to this. But as we know, what the priests say and what the masses do is not always the same. You know, all you have to do is not every religion. You know, you're told, you know, when you go to the keber, you're not supposed to be mispal to the mace. You're only using it for the zechus of the mace. You're supposed to be mispal to God. Not sure that that's always exactly what happens when people go to kvaros, and the same is true here as well. And it raises interesting questions. But that's one area in which that gets sort of recognized, challenged. Or at least the question is raised, I should say, about treating the object. Is it really an object? Is it really like an idol? There's another possibility as well, and I'm not going to read the sources inside, about why posting like Rav Avadya just ignore the iser of the concern of iser hana, which is the most obvious or the biggest concern. And that's how much do you consider the sanctuary to be a tashmish, like a pertinence, an attachment to the object that's in there? And here I'll give you another example where Poskim, when they had to make a distinction, did. The question was asked, for example, to Rav Moshe, can an architect draw the drawings, all these sources are in here, for a church? Is that a problem because you're helping them make a tashmish for the Avodah Zarah? And he basically argues that it's not directly a tashmish, it's 2 degrees removed. The tashmish to tashmish. It's not actually the space that the object is in itself, it's the space around it. It's 2 degrees removed, it's not a problem. Similarly, it's based on Gemara. Similarly, when Rav Yitzchak Elchanan was asked, Spector was asked about using a church for a synagogue, buying a church and turning it into a synagogue, that happens all the time in both directions. What?
From
Iran. Oh, really? Okay, interesting. That or sometimes movie theaters, I think, is the same type of architecture. Anyway, he says, well, it's not really a base of Avodah Zarah because it was... It's a tashmish of a tashmish, like, you know, the basic space, mostly the sanctuary serves other purposes, only 2 degrees removed is it serving that statue, and he gives those types of arguments. So those are arguments you find when they're trying to let you buy the church or let you reclaim the synagogue. I have not seen any tshuva where these arguments are made to say, and that's why you can go into the church. But I do think, I still just don't know the answer to this, but I think an argument by silence is that's why Rav Avadya only deals with it on the Drabbanan level. The entire trip of Rav Avadya, he does not mention the problem of Iser Hana. And that's already, I think, an important statement. It is, we're going to treat this again as a faith that we have, you know, that we can't say is not problematic. And at the same time, we're not going to say, like, your pagans and idolaters and the objects that you worship are treated as idols, as Avodah Zarah, and are Aser B'Hana. Other posts can do, but by silence, Rav Avadya says does not. And if you do take that approach, you're left with the last issue, which is the Maris Ayin issue. And the Maris Ayin issue about what these things look like, here there are 2 ways to address the issue. One way to address the Maris Ayin issue is that the context is obvious. Now, some posts can question this. Does context work by Avodah Zarah? Avodah Zarah is so strict we shouldn't allow context to work. But the Ramah says context does work. And sometimes if you're, you know, over in Italy and you're going into the churches and you're, you know, with your, you know, loud t-shirt and whatever shirt and you're taking pictures, the context is pretty obvious. Sometimes the context is not obvious. You know, sometimes you're going into the main entrance, you have a meeting with somebody there, nobody knows why you're going in. You know, it's not a big sign. If there's a big sign out that says bingo night or something, it's different. But sometimes context is obvious, sometimes it's not. That's really the major way to address the Maris Ayin. There is, interestingly, another point, which I'll mention, which I find conceptually interesting. We assume that Maris Ayin, like things look bad, apply. Like if I go into a McDonald's to use the bathroom, oh my gosh, is that Maris Ayin? Because people see me, they'll think I'm going to buy a cheeseburger. So, no, everybody knows, you know, you run in there for the bathroom, it's not a problem. Like, that's how you use the context argument. But some will say, no, there's a different reason. The Gemara, exactly this Gemara about going into a city that has a pagan holiday, says you can't go on the path leading into the city when there's a pagan holiday. Why not? So a lot of Rishonim assume the reason is because it looks like you're going to worship. Like going into the McDonald's to eat the cheeseburger. But Beit Yonah says that's not the case. He says it's a pilgrimage festival. So if you're walking into the city, you look like you're participating in the actual pilgrimage. And this is the question, does Maris Ayin apply only to the act itself, or what people are going to suspect the act is going to lead to? Like classic Mar sign is, I eat the hamburger with the soy cheese, and people will think it's a cheeseburger, right? Or I have the power of milk, right? That's, and I'm putting it into, you know, my, whatever, into my coffee after fleishich meal. That, if you don't understand the circumstances, you think I'm doing something wrong right now. Right? If I'm going in, if I go into the McDonald's, you don't think that's wrong. You're just suspicious about what am I doing once I get there. And there's a question if that even is defined as Mar sign. So those are reasons to think that the case of the church might not be such a problem. But in general, we tend to assume those cases are, and we focus on the issue of context. So let me now try to pull it together, because you were told it was going to be practical. So let me try to pull it together, okay, which is the following. One way of dealing with the church is the mirror, saying Christianity is not a bodhisattva even for us, and, you know, go into the churches like that statement by Rav Yosef Kalbach. I've explained why I think that it's going against a long history of psak, and also in principle, I find that a little problematic. I think we should be grappling with issues about, you know, recognizing there are things that are problematic in terms of faith, that we have serious, profound faith commitments, and we can't just sort of eliminate those issues. So then the question becomes about going into these places. How does one deal with it? So one question is that it looks that it's going to lead you astray. For some posting like Rav Moshe, that's a big issue. For others, that's a non-issue in most cases. Again, some cases this maybe is a concern. Okay, I have to tell one last joke. So Chaim and Yosef are walking by a church and it's about leading you astray, and they see a big sign up and it says, $20,000 for every Jew converted to Christianity. So looking at each other, and they're saying, okay, you know, it's Christianity, $20,000. So they're just debating, like, what should they do? Should I convert you? You convert me. Finally, they decide Yosef's going to go in and turn himself in, get the $20,000, come out, report to Chaim, and then Chaim will decide what to do. So Yosef goes in, and Chaim is waiting 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. Finally, Yosef comes out. Chaim says, you? How did it go? Did you get the money? That's all you Jews think about, money. So one is the concern about that it'll lead you astray. The other is the concern about the real serious concern of Isser Hanah. And for some posts, and that's huge, right? Isser Hanah is an Isser D'oraita. So that requires assuming that the objects are like idols, are like objects that are worshipped, not just are generated, but our worship or veneration counts as worship, and some posts assume that. The Rabbi Yosef just ignores that whole category. I have to tell you that the difference, if you recognize the severity of that, because that is the one biblical concern that could apply here, that really is the difference between Catholic churches and Protestant churches. And when people ask me this question, I find it much, much easier to allow cases of non-Catholic churches than Catholic churches, because Catholic churches, you're really dealing with what, according to a number of poskim, is a biblical prohibition related to not of idolatry itself, but related to avodah zarah, deriving benefit. When Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, in that letter that's going to be published, speaks about why it's allowed to go into churches, he focuses on the Isser of Hanah, and he gives a whole, you know, complicated argument why going into a church is not real Hanah. You're not really deriving benefit. And even though you like looking at some art, that's not real benefit, and he gives a whole argument about why it's not Hana'ah. So, but that is Catholic churches for me, the sanctuary, not the outer space. The sanctuary, which is directly where those statues are, that is the most challenging question about churches, because those are the places where, according to some, you're dealing with a biblical prohibition. When you're dealing,
what if you go in and you don't enjoy it?
Well, so then the question is also, so the question is, it's not just about enjoying the art. The question is, it's a sunny day, and you go in and you enjoy the shade, right? So that's like what Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz said. Well, the shade is not really the Ikar Hanan. He gives a whole lumdus why it's not called Hanan. So that's what Catholic Church is. And then the one that applies to all, and even to Protestant, but I really feel is can be addressed in, depending on the circumstances, is the question of appearances and Maris Ayin, and they're really context to make a difference. So if you're having, in a non-Catholic church, you're having a concert, or you're going there for other purposes, you know, that context is obvious. Those, I think, I'm giving no psukim, by the way. Anybody wants to ask me a personal child about psak, you know, I'll talk to them afterwards, but I'm talking here sort of a general approach. Those are a lot easier when the context is obvious. Okay, so Those are what I really think are the core, the three issues. The Mars Ayin is the one which has to be dealt with in all cases, but often can be easily, sometimes not so easily, but anyway, often can be addressed. And the Hana is the biggest challenge when it comes to sanctuaries within the Catholic, in Catholic churches. And it is interesting, again, to remember that some postkin don't even mention it. But other postkin, you know, treat it very seriously. And that has to do, I think, with, it's one thing to say Christianity is a Vodazara, it's another thing to say that these objects are like idols and are Isurei Hana. And how much do we deal with those? But I have a lot harder time when people ask me questions about Catholic churches, although I can see a way that it would be possible to be lenient based on what I've outlined. And that really gets us back to the theme I opened with, which is I'm much more comfortable struggling with that question. I mean, maybe the person asking me the shaila isn't getting the answer they're looking for. You know, if they just want me to say it's permissible. But I'm much more comfortable with really thinking, okay, I'm, you know, on the one hand, according to some, it's an Isser Hanoa, but a Zara, it's very weighty. On the other hand, you know, here's the reason, and you can also make this argument and that argument, and sometimes the answer is no, and sometimes the answer is yes. And I think that that's much truer to the tradition, you know, to the halachic, to the way halacha has dealt with this. And again, I really think that it's very important in terms of making it clear that we actually do have serious theological commitments. And we do actually have some red lines. Most of the time when I have to be honest, because for, it is, you know, for some postcard, when Mr. Joe writes or relates to Avodah Zarah, I really have not, you know, I understand that there's some situations that really should, you know, are very serious, like, you know, there are times heads of state, but, you know, great Reverend Shai Yashir Cohen and other great rabbis, and, you know, and that's actually, as we saw, Yosef Carvel, others have gone into those churches, and we know that that happens, and so on. People in their personal lives will have take cases. A very close friend or a colleague is having a wedding, is having a funeral at a church, what can they do? And I still tell people to try to find a way to wait outside of the actual sanctuary itself and not to go into the sanctuary. And because, as I said, I really think that there's a lot of serious, you know, halachic debate around these issues, and I'm reluctant to just, you know, to mock here these cases. But I see what the arguments are, and I think it's this grappling that we have to sort of engage with when we're thinking about our relationship to our Christianity, which is very different than the question of our relationship to Christians. And I want to end by saying that I do recognize that that's the trade-off, that when you use the label of Avodah Zarah, it can lead to the type of spitting at the monks and spitting at the priests that we started the discussion with. I think that's a bigger problem, like I said, maybe in Israel. I think hopefully here for people with modern sensibilities and living in a country which has freedom of religion and where we are given rights as a minority religion, I really think that the basic human issue values of reciprocity counterbalance that, but I do recognize that that's the trade-off and that's the challenge. Okay, so I will end with that. It's already, oh my gosh, it's already 9:40. I was told to make it an hour, so I appreciate everybody's patience and attention. Maybe I'll just take one or two questions. I know it's very late, so if people have more questions, then they can leave because I don't want to, yes. People are already leaving, which is fine.
Right.
Yeah, if the church is no longer used, that might be considered bittul, like it's being nullified. That gets to the question about how does the act of bittul work. But definitely when it goes into churches in Europe that are no longer used, there's another reason to be lenient, is to assume that the fact that it's completely, you know, it's no longer used, is an act of bittul. But that goes into the specifics of bittul, which is debated. Yes. Right. That I think was in the description. Well, the other issue about that was, let me say two quick things. One thing I did not discuss was presence and participation when actual worship is going on. Now that's not there. There are people who are saying prayers, but for example, if you're at a place where, let's say, forget the church issue, you're at a mass that happens on the outdoors. I don't know if they ever happen in the outdoors, but anyway, but let's bracket the church issue. To what degree is your presence a Mars Ayin? And besides the Mars Ion issue, I think the really interesting question is, to what degree is your respectful presence a type of participation? And I don't know how to answer that. You know, obviously the people are expected to have a very ritual type of a response, specific response to the mass service. There's a whole thing that the priest says and that the congregation responds. But if you're there and you're being respectful and you're standing and sitting together with everybody else, even if you're sort of not making the cross and not responding, at what stage is that considered to be a form of participation? I really don't know the answer. I will tell you an extreme example, though. The Soldatik said that when Kennedy's funeral took place, that he said that people should not watch it on TV because it was a mass service and because the Pope had ruled that watching mass on TV is considered participating in the mass. So he said to watch mass would be to participate. So, and that was repeated it was on the YU website when, not for Bob Kennedy's funeral, but for, Ted Kennedy, but I think for, also for Princess Diana and another time. Anyway, they republished that. So that's another question, which is what is considered participation, which I have not seen good discussion of, and the TV seems an extreme example. The other issue is, when people that have an opportunity to be close to heads of state, often a lot of restrictions are waived. And that's always been the practice within, it goes back to the Gemara and the Rambam and, Nishum Eva, and there's specific examples about Droris, because the Karov Lamalchus is a identified category in Halacha, people that have, access to political leaders that, waiving of certain restrictions. So, I think that was, that what Rav Lichtenstein did was, certainly very defensible. And look, and the other thing I think that I could not fathom is why, even if the RCA did not agree with what he did, why they felt the need to publicize, that I could not even begin to fathom. Saying a joint prayer service, Rav Moshe Feinstein says that as long as it's a neutral language, it's okay. He doesn't want the neutral language to be written by priests because he's afraid that there'll be some hidden, messages, but he says you can participate in a joint prayer service as long as the language is neutral. People have different ideas of what neutral is. I'll just share that my son, I have a son that has special needs, and he goes to a secular school, non-Jewish school, they were doing some, for music, they were doing choir music, but we were sure that it was all very Tarav and all the text, and there was nothing that was denominational. So then I hear that he's singing a song which is about God our Savior. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, I also believe that God is my Savior, but I don't think that's God. I can really feel that that's neutral language. So that's the point that Rav Moshe makes about prayer services, about what type of language are you using. Yes.
Getting to your nugget for a segment, but Rishonim, people like Rambam who were living in the Muslim country, who think so much of the Talmud. How much do they really know about Christianity? We were first talking to a Catholic theologian in the area.
Vermont.
So are we basing so much of a practical halacha on? Dare I say it, perhaps it's
an unreality,
right, what
we're
talking about.
Right, I think that is an excellent point, I actually had even meant to say that at the outset of my talk, here I'm going to spend an hour and a half talking about this, what direct knowledge do I have of this either? I know what I mean, I speak to people again. The way to really do this is to hear from people that are representatives of their faith, and I think that Dr. Mark Shapiro once commented that the irony is that we continue to make Fahim about Christianity, and at the same time say that it's up to the talk to Christian theologians, so we're continuing to sort of make decisions in ignorance, and there are times when clearly, folks can have a limited understanding. Now again, the problem is that you never get the full picture. Even people are trying to sort of, be honest, which is, so let's take the issue about worshiping the images. Theologians will say, no, of course the images aren't worshiped. They're just there for pedagogical purposes and for veneration and so on. But, I just searched the web before this class, and you find Catholics, writing on blogs about how they believe that their fellow Catholics are owed the Avodah Zarah, and they more or less say that because they really worship the object. So what happens, on the ground? But I think you are absolutely correct that a piece that is missing almost all the time from these discussions is really directly engaging the other rather than just talking about the other. I very much appreciate
it. It's interesting that Mark Shapiro teaches at the University of Scranton, which is a Catholic.
Right. Right. Yes. So two more questions, and then we'll wrap up.
I have a question about the Interhanan.
Yeah.
So I had a coworker at a previous job who was a pretty firm Hindu.
Yeah.
And he had a little tessel of an elephant, which was apparently the Hindu god of Parnassus.
Right.
And he had it on his monitor, and he would sit and, you know, type, and I guess at some point during the day give thanks to his god of Parnassus.
Right.
What if I owned the company? Could I have such a person work for me?
It goes to questions about Lotavi Toyeva, be careful what happens if somebody brings into your state.
Yeah.
You could find ways, similar like how do you own a company over Shabbos, you know, you could find ways that you sublet the space to him so it's not technically your property that he's bringing into. You know, there would be workarounds, is what I would say. But there are issues about those. And that, by the way, I should say, is a really underexplored issue, you know. After we get through all of the issues about Christianity, you know, Hinduism is a big, it's a much bigger challenge. Okay, two more questions, then we're going to have a
comment on Hinduism.
Yes.
The Rabbanut Rashid entered into an agreement with the Hindu community in India.
Yes.
And the document that they agreed on says that Hinduism is monotheist.
Really? Very interesting.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Because they'll also say that all these things are basically, you know, manifestations of the one true God. Although Hindus, even though they'll say that all of their other gods are manifestations of the one true God, they will, I think, be very clear, though, that they really believe that a power inheres in the objects themselves, and that they bring the energy through the objects and so on. They might not call it a god, but, you know, again, the use of the image is there. There's one thing about the theology, monotheism, polytheism, and then there's the other question about how do they relate to their objects of worship. Okay, last question.
What's the distinction in Protestant churches between Unitarian churches and Trinitarian churches?
Uh-huh.
The latter would be a Vodazara law.
Right.
Do you know of any other post who discussed?
Yes. Who did you say, by the way?
Well.
A number of them do. In this packet, you'll see a tshuva from Yehuda Herzl Hankin, who says Unitarian churches are not a problem, and you can go into them, but then he says, but people won't know the difference, so you shouldn't. but he says, in principle, they're not, and there are a number of posts that do say that about Unitarian. I'm trying to remember who else I saw said that. I can't remember offhand, but it's definitely but that's a very small.
You're dying out anyway.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all.